This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A lot of people experience gastrointestinal problems like bloating, gas, and constipation. The list goes on. But what causes the problems? A lot of people don't get a clear answer at the doctor, so sometimes they go online to try to figure it out.
We have an expert with us to talk about gut health. But what questions do you have? Have you ever experienced serious gastrointestinal problems? Was there something at work for you? Some advice to share? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
Our guest is Dr. Robin Shutkun. She's a gastroenterologist and author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. She's also the founder of the Digestive Center for Women. Dr. Robin Shutkun, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems like gut health is something that is really cresting in terms of how aware people are of it. A lot of people realizing they're not feeling so good in the stomach and their digestive areas. But there's not a lot of information, it seems like, about how to address those problems. Would you say that this is something that's been overlooked?
Absolutely. You know, Hippocrates said, long before I said it, that all disease begins in the gut. And he actually was right. The GI tract is sort of the central wheel, and the different parts of the body are the spokes that come off it. And if from a digestive point of view, all is not well in your digestive tract, it's really hard for the rest of you to feel well. Bloating is something that's been ignored for a long time because it's something that women often complain of and doctors think it's not serious, but it can be a real sign that all is not well in your digestive tract, and it's definitely worth paying attention to.
Well, what kinds of symptoms should we be worried about?
Well, bloating on its own is generally more of a nuisance symptom than a sign of something serious, but in association with other symptoms, it actually can be a signal that there is something very serious going on. For example, ovarian cancer, it's often called a silent killer. But what we realize now is that persistent bloating can be a major sign of ovarian cancer and something that shouldn't be ignored, particularly if it's associated with abdominal pain or weight loss. Same for some more other worrisome diagnoses. So, for example, colon cancer can cause bloating, usually with associated rectal bleeding. Some other conditions like Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune condition. So bloating on its own is not necessarily worrisome, but in conjunction with things like blood in the stool or bleeding in between your menstrual cycle, significant weight loss, more than 10% of your body weight without trying, abdominal pain, these are the sorts of things that should make you seek medical attention for your bloating.
So those are some of the more serious things. On the other hand, it sounds like there are symptoms that we experience when things just are not functioning the way that they should with our digestive health. We could be feeling better. We could be digesting better, but we're not. What are some of the things in terms of the non-scary disease realm that we can do for everyday health?
So, Veronica, there's a couple big categories here, and the food is a huge one. So lactose intolerance, for example, more than 50% of the world's population is lactose intolerant and can't digest dairy. And that might be you. Lots of people eat dairy every day, not necessarily drinking milk, but eating yogurt or cheese, and they feel kind of bloated and uncomfortable every day, and they don't really put the two together. My book has a 10-day plan. It's really a simple elimination diet, and I ask people to get rid of the 6 most common foods associated with bloating, and it very conveniently spells out SAD gas. So the SAD part is soy, artificial sweeteners, and dairy, and the GAS part, gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Soy bloats you because if you eat enough processed soy, it can have estrogen-like effects, causing you to retain water. Artificial sweeteners aren't absorbed in the small intestine. That's why they don't contribute any calories, but they get fermented by bacteria in the large intestine, and they produce a lot of gas that can really bloat you. And then dairy, we talked about, lots of people are lactose intolerant and don't realize it. The gas part can be challenging, the gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Of course, it's a relatively small number of Americans who have celiac disease, which is an actual allergy to gluten, the protein in wheat, rye, and barley. But millions more are gluten intolerant and have bloating and other symptoms, fatigue, sometimes brain fog from gluten. Alcohol in moderation, most people tolerate pretty well, but alcohol can really irritate the lining of the GI tract, and it also decreases production of digestive enzymes that help you break down food. And of course, it just can add calories and inches to your waistline. And then sugar, this is a really tough one, so for most people to give up, or at least to cut down on significantly. When you eat a lot of sugary food, you end up feeding the wrong kind of bacteria in your gut, and you end up with overgrowth of yeast species and some not-so-friendly bacteria that end up producing a lot of gas and bloating you. So what I recommend is eliminating SAD gas, these 6 foods, for 10 days, you'll probably feel a lot better. But if you decide, gosh, there's something I'm really missing and I'm not sure it was really that, I recommend reintroducing one category at a time, sort of a week at a time. If you eliminate sad gas and you feel great and then you go out and have a bagel and all of a sudden you're massively bloated and uncomfortable, that might help you figure out that gluten is the culprit. And you don't necessarily need to avoid it 100% if you don't have celiac disease, but maybe 80% of the time.
Now, in terms of probiotics, that's something that we hear a lot about today. We didn't maybe 10, 15 years ago, but these days, probiotics, the bacteria in the gut, are linked to things like brain health and being able to be resistant to depression. How much do probiotics matter and good bacteria in the gut?
So, Veronica, the microbiome, the billions and trillions of bacteria in your digestive system that make up the microbiome are an absolutely fascinating area, because what we're realizing is that what you can't see, the gut bacteria, may be more important than what you can. They're incredibly important, not just for the health of the digestive lining, which will determine how well you absorb stuff and whether you have gas or not, but for your immune system. So what we're finding is that kids who are given frequent antibiotics in childhood often will develop autoimmune diseases like asthma and certain allergies like Crohn's, lupus, even diabetes later in life. The Italians are actually quite far ahead of us in the gut bacteria research. And one Italian researcher in particular, Dr. Leonetti in Florence, he did a fascinating study where he looked at the gut bacteria of kids in Florence eating a standard, sort of typical Western diet, high in sugar, fat, and meat. And he looked at a group of kids in Burkina Faso eating a mostly plant-based diet with legumes and the occasional termite. And he found that the gut bacteria at birth in both sets of kids were virtually identical. But as soon as the kids migrated to table food, the gut bacteria changed dramatically. The kids in Florence eating the Western diet had less species diversity. So in other words, they had fewer types of bacteria, which is a real problem. It turns out bacterial diversity is really important. And they had more species associated with obesity, inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, and autoimmune diseases. The Burkina Faso kids eating the very unprocessed plant-based diet had species associated with leanness and with less disease. Now, if we take a step forward, what people have sort of put together is like, well, even if you're eating a not-so-great Western diet, we'll just give you back some bacteria. And so a probiotic might seem like a great idea. The problem is we've only isolated several hundred species of gut bacteria. And of that number, we can only culture and grow just a handful of them outside of the gut reliably, things like bifidobacteria, acidophilus, lactobacillus. There are probably hundreds of thousands more gut bacteria that we don't even know of. We haven't yet made their acquaintance that are really important for gut health. So one of the really fascinating areas that we're seeing now, and it has a little bit of a yuck factor for anyone who's squeamish, but is something called FMT, fecal microbiome transplants, where we actually take stool from a healthy donor and we insert it into the intestines of somebody with an infection. We're using it now for an infection called Clostridium difficile. And I think this is really the way of the future. It's not the probiotic, which a probiotic is kind of like a vitamin. You know, if you decide that tomatoes, if you do a study and you find that people who eat tomatoes are heart healthy and they have fewer heart attacks, and you say, gosh, well, tomatoes contain lycopene, so I'm going to make a vitamin with lycopene and give it to people and see if they have fewer heart attacks. That's all well and good, but there are probably 50,000 other things in the tomato that are really what are helping the heart, and so it's much better to eat a tomato. So again, pardon the yuck factor, but it's probably better to do the whole stool transfer, or even better, follow the dietary habits of the people who have a healthy microbiome.
So does that mean we should be trying to eat things that are fermented more, sauerkraut and miso and pickles and things like that? Is that where we get those good bacteria?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So fermented pickled foods are a great source of good gut bacteria. High fiber foods, particularly foods that contain a lot of inulin, like artichokes and asparagus, are another great source. Leafy greens. So increasing those foods are great. And then the other part of that is cutting down on the foods that we know promote the growth of the wrong kind of bacteria, the undesirables. So that's a diet that's high in fat and meat, sugary, starchy, sort of processed, unfortunately, the standard American diet. So it's not just a simple matter of going out to the pharmacy and getting a probiotic. That's not going to take you that far. If you really have a depleted microbiome, you really have to change your diet. And then another huge part of that, Veronica, is avoiding probably the number one threat to your microbiome, and that's unnecessary antibiotics. We know that most of the time when you have a cold or a sinus infection, it's viral or it's a mild bacterial infection that's going to be self-limited. And so when you take antibiotics in that setting when you don't really need them, you kill off a lot of good gut bacteria that, again, can't just be replaced at the drugstore. So my general advice to patients is, you know, if you really have some very severe illness, absolutely take your antibiotic, but don't reach for an antibiotic every time you sneeze or have a cold.
Well, we're talking right now to Dr. Robert Schutken. She's a gastroenterologist and the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage.
You can join in. Are we talking about you? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our guest is Dr. Robin Schutken, gastroenterologist and author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. She's also the founder of the Digestive Center for Women. And we're talking about the GI problems that people develop. Sometimes they fly under the radar. We don't really notice them. We just notice we're not feeling that great. And we're getting some advice on how to combat that now.
And we're taking your calls, your advice, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
All right. So, Robin, let's go to the phones right now. We have Shandy with us in Rhinelander. Hi, Shandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting topic to me because for the last 10 years I've struggled with gut issues.
And what have you found?
Well, 10 years ago I had a hysterectomy. I still have my ovaries, but then I developed IBS. And I tried, you know, diets and prescription medications and probiotics and all sorts of things. And we do know it's hormonally based or triggered. And what we tried just to see if it would work with a low dose of antidepressants with the serotonin, and that actually has, it's not perfect, but it's much better.
What do you think helped about that?
Shandy, I'm so glad to hear from you, and I'm so pleased to hear you're doing better. So, you know, you raise a really important issue here with the serotonin. Serotonin is what we consider the feel-good hormone in the body, and the majority of it is located in the GI tract. So sometimes boosting serotonin levels with drugs like antidepressants can actually really help when with conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. But IBS is one of these diagnoses that I have a bit of a difficult time with because it means irritable bowel syndrome, but it doesn't tell us anything about why your bowel is irritable. And if we slice up the IBS pie, we find all kinds of things from undiagnosed celiac disease to hormonal imbalances, undiagnosed parasites, Crohn's disease, gluten intolerance. So I think when you get a diagnosis like irritable bowel, it's really important to try and pinpoint what exactly is causing the problem. And I'm so delighted that you, through lots of trial and error, were able to figure out what it is. Best of luck to you.
So it sounds like IBS is sort of an umbrella, and then from there, people need to dig deeper.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. They need to keep digging because it's sort of like if you came in to see me and you said you were really tired and I said, well, you have tired disease and here's a pill to pep you up. You know, like sort of like, well,
right.
Why am I tired? You know, is it my thyroid? Is it what's going on?
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Shandy. And we'll move on to Tom next in Delafield. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I'd just like to add or share what happens to me on occasion. I would get very severe gas pains, and it would, you know, pretty much bring me to my knees, and it would wrap all the way around from my back all the way through my midsection, you know, all the way around. And what my chiropractor told me about that is that there's certain vertebrae that get pinched, it will affect the nerves going to the GI tract, and it would cause this type of gas buildup. And I'm pretty sure that he's right, because when this happens, I can kind of self-adjust this. I lay flat on the floor with a towel rolled up under my back, you know, right where I feel that the vertebrae need to be pushed back into place. And within just a matter of minutes, if I get that into starts to dissipate and I'm, you know, back up and running again.
Interesting. So, what do you make of that, Robin?
Tom, thank you, first of all, so much for sharing. And I love to hear these stories where people are, you know, being medical detectives and figuring it out. And with the help of your trusted chiropractor who came up with some really clever ideas here. And, you know, in my book, I mentioned this thing called happy abs, where people lie on their back with something heated on their belly to sort of relax the abdominal muscles and to relax the GI tract, which is also muscular structure. And then they take a very light dumbbell, like 1 or 2 pounds, and they circumnavigate the belly button in a clockwise direction to try and push air out. Yours is a little bit different because it actually has to do with your spine and the vertebrae. But again, it's just a great example of how we need to listen to our bodies and pay attention and find the right people who can help us figure out how to feel better. There's always a reason why you're bloated, why you're having digestive distress. And I really, really encourage our listeners to not just accept that this is how it is, but to roll up their sleeves and figure out why they're not feeling well and try and improve it, whether it's a food you need to eliminate, something you need to add, a massage technique you need to do, something going on with your spine. Keep searching for some answers.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Tom. And let's go next to Pam in the Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about I've been diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 2 years now. But my GI doctor that I have right now, he's not real sure I have Crohn's. He still thinks I have IBS. So I had one GI doctor say you have it and one who's not real sure. But they are treating me. I take Humira injections. I take methotrexate. I take a whole bunch of vitamins. And I have a gluten-free, a soy-free, no beef. Let's say I do it about 95% of the time. Beef, and I am feeling so much better.
All right, so a lot of treatments that you're giving yourself that are helping. Sounds like Pam has been a detective as well.
Absolutely.
Dr. Chuck, what about that?
I love the dietary changes, Pam. But, you know, Crohn's disease and IBS are two very different diseases, and it's really important to figure out which one it is, because while the drugs you're on are really effective, and they're drugs that I use in my practice, Humira and methotrexate, they're also pretty heavy-duty guns. I mean, methotrexate can cause liver problems, and Humira can cause, it's an immune suppressant, and it, you know, can cause, in rare circumstances, cancer. So it's really important to find out whether you have Crohn's or not. If one doctor says yes and one doctor says no, maybe a third opinion is in order, because if you cannot take those drugs, that would be fantastic. I applaud your dietary changes, and I would say keep going with that. But I think it really is very, very important to find out. Crohn's is a serious autoimmune disorder, and as a result, the drugs we use are very effective, but they have a lot of side effects. Irritable bowel, you can manage more through dietary modification and some drugs that are more benign. So really encourage you to maybe seek a third opinion and figure out whether you truly have Crohn's or not. But I'm glad you're feeling better.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Pam. Appreciate hearing your story. And Dr. Chuckin, why is it so hard to diagnose these things?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that even today in 2013, the lag from onset of symptoms to diagnosis for Crohn's disease is 4.5 years.
Ooh,
it's really an unbelievable amount of time considering all our modern technology and all these diagnostic things we can do. But that's because the symptoms often develop before we see a lot of active inflammation in the GI tract. And then sometimes with Crohn's, the areas where we get things like ulcers and narrowing are deep within the GI tract. And the GI tract is sort of this 30-foot superhighway from the mouth to the anus. But the changes in Crohn's often occur deep in the small bowel, beyond the reach of our typical endoscopes that we use for doing colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. And, you know, I will say that there's still a real bias in the medical community when women come in to chalk it up to stress. And, you know, we see it in other fields, too. In the emergency room, woman comes in clutching her chest, what we call the classic Levine side of a heart attack, and she often gets Mylanta and gets put in a corner. Man comes in the same age with the same symptoms, clutching his chest, and he gets rushed up to the cath lab for them to check out his heart, even though heart disease is the number one killer of women. So I think there's still this bias to say that, you know, stress is a major component in women. Even the very word for uterus hysteros comes from the Greek, which means hysterical. So they, you know, even the ancient Greeks thought that we were a little bit dramatic. And while we know that stress is a contributor to every illness, lots of times there's something real. There's some a physiological, anatomical basis for symptoms, which brings me to one of my favorite male-female issues. And I will point out that bloating is an equal opportunity employer. Things like food and air swallowing, a condition called aerophagia that can make you go up a pant size in a day, and conditions like diverticulosis and gallbladder problems, those affect men and women. But there is a particular difference between males and females that make women more susceptible to bloating, and that's our colons. Women have a colon that, on average, is 10 centimeters longer than the male colon. And we think that's to allow for more absorption during childbirth. We also have a deeper, wider pelvis, so our colon sits really deep. It has to compete for space with our female reproductive organs, the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. So the female colon looks like a Six Flags roller coaster, and the male colon is a nice, gentle horseshoe. And so it means in women, the products of digestion, the gas, the air, the stool has to travel through all these twists and turns and loops and loop-de-loops and switchbacks just to come out. Women also have lower testosterone levels, and in men, higher testosterone levels mean a stronger abdominal wall that binds the bowel in place. It's like a built-in Spanx. So even when men have a bare belly, they'll complain of being fat, but often not of being bloated because of their tighter abdominal wall. So these are all things to take into consideration. Women have more undiagnosed thyroid disease, which can cause bloating, fluctuating progesterone and estrogen levels. So we have a couple advantages when it comes to bloating that actually turn out to be disadvantages.
If you could just give the people listening one tip to help with things like this, what would you tell them?
So I'm going to give you just an easy, all-natural bloating tip, and that is fennel seeds and ginger. So assuming that your bloating is not from something serious, but maybe you ate something that didn't agree with you, boil some fennel seeds and make a tea. Strain the seeds off. You can use a little honey to sweeten and make a fennel tea. Very soothing for the GI tract. Fennel is from the carrot and parsley family, has lots of medicinal qualities. Ginger chews are another great way. Now, don't overdo it with ginger candy, which has a lot of sugar in it, but you can get a little bit of caramelized ginger, and you can keep them in your purse, and ginger is another great natural bloat buster. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for that idea, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Robin Chutton. She is a gastroenterologist and the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage.